everyone, and welcome to episode 168 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, this week I decided it's been a while since I answered your question, so I put out the call on social media and on our Patreon and asked if you had any questions, burning questions about the Middle Ages that maybe I could help you with. And so today I'm going to be answering the questions that people asked me on social media and on Patreon, and I'm going to be covering kind of a wide range of things that really depends on the questions that I'm asked. So buckle up, everybody. We're going to be talking about your most burning questions about the Middle Ages, coming up right after this. All right, so let's get into it. Now, I'm going to answer the most difficult and emotional question at first. If you find this is a difficult subject for you, please come back in about 3 minutes. Everything else I'm going to answer is going to be much easier, but I want to get this answered up front so that we have some clear markers for how much time to skip. So this is about non-viable pregnancies. So if this is a difficult topic for you, please come back in about 3 minutes and everything from there on will be safe, I promise. So the question I was asked on Twitter was, did medieval midwives have a therapy for treating women who carry non-viable pregnancies? This is a very topical question in today's day and age. So let me just say right up front, whatever I say about medieval methods in expelling a fetus for medical purposes, please do not use them ever. These are very dangerous cures and they didn't really work anyway. So if you are struggling on your own, please see Planned Parenthood. Don't ever use a medieval remedy for pregnancy issues or really any issues at all. So the best place to find an answer for this is in the Trotula, because this is a compendium of women's medicine. And this is a book that I talked about with Monica Green, who compiled the best version of this that you can find. The Trotula is amazing as a source. Basically, there was no way to find out if a pregnancy was viable at all, because no one had the diagnostic tools that we do today. So if you were carrying a fetus, if you're pregnant, then you were in it right up until the very end. So there were times, of course, when a fetus did die in utero, and in those cases, they were trying to expel the fetus. So if a fetus was obviously dead in utero, what would they do? They would suggest that you ingested certain herbal concoctions to expel it. So these would involve things like rue and mugwort, pepper and salt water, and a whole bunch of other different things. But I'm mentioning these ones because rue and mugwort are ones that were always meant to bring on the menses. So these are ones that were meant to create a flow of menses, whether this meant kind of covertly talking about abortion or just a cure to make sure that people are menstruating. But things like pepper were meant to cause sneezing, which was meant to expel the fetus from the body. Pepper is also used during childbirth to try and sneeze out a full-term baby as well. So these are all very uncomfortable ways to make the body contract and try and push out a fetus. So there isn't an actual therapy for like what you do if there's a non-viable pregnancy. You're basically in it until something happens, the fetus comes full term or it dies in utero, and then you try and expel it through sneezing or vomiting or taking a cure, quote unquote cure, that's going to be really damaging. So that is the most difficult thing we're going to be talking about today. In order to not have a difficult pregnancy, of course, I thought I would bring to you the more fun part of this advice, which was that if people thought that you were going to have trouble in pregnancy, they thought you should not actually have sex in the first place. So Avicenna, who is the guru of all things medieval medical theory, was suggesting that there are a bunch of things you can do if you don't want to get pregnant. So we talked about this a little bit on a couple of other episodes. I had one with Eleanor Yaniga, one with Monica Green, but this is from a collection of medieval medical treatises that was collected by Winston Black, who I've talked to a couple times on the podcast as well. So Avicenna says, if you don't want to get pregnant, especially if you think it's going to be dangerous for you, there's a bunch of things that you could do. One is, of course, the rhythm method. He says, make sure that you're not having sex at times when you could get pregnant. Pulling out is another one. jumping backwards after sex, vigorously jumping backwards 8 or 9 times is supposed to help you not get pregnant. Sneezing, of course, you can use pepper to help you sneeze, or you can use different things that are going to have contraceptive qualities, at least according to the best wisdom of the Middle Ages, which is not the best wisdom of today. It bears repeating: pennyroyal, willow leaves, pomegranate, elephant dung. These things will help you not to get pregnant. So there you have it. The best medieval advice for not getting pregnant is jumping up and down and sneezing a bunch of times. So there you go. If you are a neighbor to somebody following Avicenna's advice, you're going to know exactly what was going on with your neighbors if you hear lots of jumping up and down and sneezing. Okay, moving on to perhaps safer topics. JC asked me on Twitter, what were medieval diapers / nappies like in the Middle Ages, and when did babies usually toilet train? And I gotta say, a lot of the questions that people are asking me this week are very difficult questions. You're asking them because you already know a lot about the Middle Ages and you maybe don't know these things. And that is because nobody knows these things. They're actually quite mysterious. So as for diapers, there wasn't really a lot, right? This is one of the reasons I would never actually want to live in the Middle Ages. So we know that there are some materials like wool that are very, very absorbent, but they're scratchy too. So what would you be using to kind of collect the nasty stuff that comes out of babies every once in a while? Well, you'd be swaddling your baby in linen, and you might be packing underneath their bottoms more linen or wool. I would say linen would be the thing that's closest to the skin, but we don't actually know. People do talk about diapers in the Middle Ages, but they don't mention what they're made of, how often you should change them, nothing like that. So it's a good question, JC, because we are still trying to figure that one out. And as soon as we know, I will let you know, because you can bet I'll do a podcast on medieval diapers. This is interesting stuff, and I want to learn more too. As for toilet training, how did they do it? How quickly did they do it? This is another thing that's kind of mysterious. So, of course, I went to Nicholas Orme's book on medieval children and confirmed medieval toilet training happened as quickly as possible. There are some people that have theories that suggest that medieval children, toddlers, didn't wear pants. They wore kind of a dress, like a sheath, so that if they had to go, at least you wouldn't have to keep changing pants. But of course, you want to toilet train them as soon as possible. So we know that they had chamber pots and sometimes child-sized chamber pots that toddlers could use to start training themselves. We don't actually have a lot of information other than that on how children were toilet trained. But I mean, it is something that is pretty difficult to deal with. So this is going to be happening as soon as possible. Some people suggest as soon as toddlers know how to sit, they can sit on a potty and make life easier for everyone. Okay, so next, Steve from Twitter asked, do we have any records of what lay people felt when they first entered a new church or cathedral? So I looked around and I couldn't find any, at least on my shelf, any examples of lay people's reactions when they first walked into a church or cathedral. So lay people being people who are not affiliated with the church. But one of the things you were getting at in your tweet, Steve, is that, of course, there's probably a feeling of awe. And I think that is absolutely correct. I think somebody walking into a church is meant to feel awe. And I think anybody walking into a church or cathedral today, one of these big ones, the big Gothic medieval ones, is going to feel probably a little bit of that same awe when you walk in. Back in the day, these were buildings that not only had that stonework, that beautiful artistry on the outside, they had the stained glass on the inside, and they were also painted. So these were places that were actually so inspiring to walk into because they were full of that riotous color, not to mention all of these really important symbols of the religion that people who are walking into that church are following, right? So I think that you do have that sense of awe. Well, it's something that I couldn't find an actual direct quote pointing at. I think that it's definitely something that we can imagine people felt. I think that it's really hard not to feel awe when you walk into a cathedral for the first time. So even though I couldn't find a primary source as to that, Steve, I think that you're on track and that people would be feeling awe when they walked in. The second part of Steve's question is, why are there so many church clock faces that are blue with gold hands? And this is something I couldn't find the answer to directly, but I think that the answer is probably a pretty simple one in that blue pigment is pretty expensive. It's rare when you compare it to things like green pigment. So if it's made of mosaic, for example, it'd be made from cobalt or azure or lapis. So it's expensive. Blue is an expensive color. It's also really affiliated with the Virgin Mary. In part, I think, this is my own personal theory, because it's such an expensive pigment. So it's not necessarily that the Virgin Mary has like blueness about her in the Bible or anything like that. I think that people were worshiping her and wanting to make these beautiful pictures that are using the most expensive pigment that they could in order to be devotional. So I imagine that this is probably the same reason why you have a lot of blue clock faces. And if I'm wrong about this, I'm hoping that somebody will write in and tell me, correct me on this. But I think it's probably because it's impressive, it's devotional, and this all really has to do with the fact that blue is an expensive pigment. Whether you're making ink or you're making mosaic tiles, blue is a pretty expensive one. Why do they have gold? Well, gold is also very expensive. It's evocative of things like richness. And that is always really important when you're talking about a religious symbol, right? Even if it's a clock on the outside of a church or the outside of a town hall, it's a symbol of that richness, that devotion, and all of that kind of stuff. So I don't have a specific answer. I don't know if anyone's researched this, but I couldn't find, you know, a specific answer as to why these are blue with gold on them. But clocks tend to be blue, I think, with gold accents because it makes it look expensive, and it probably was expensive to make. And anytime you can show off wealth as both, you know, something to show your status and something to show your devotion, that's something that you'd want to do and that people tended to do in the Middle Ages. Mary Kay asked a really good question on Twitter, and that was, is there evidence that people slept more in the winter and less in the summer in the northern latitudes? And do we know much about sleep patterns outside of monasteries? Good questions. So the short answer is we don't know a lot about sleep outside of monasteries. But the stuff we know about monasteries is very cool and I think very revealing. So when it comes to monasteries, monks and nuns are getting up in the middle of the night to pray. This is part of the canonical hours. So they're getting up for matins after midnight. Sometimes it's really hard to calculate these things, but around midnight, after midnight, up till about 3 o'clock in the morning, anytime in that window, they're getting up for matins and they're praying for a couple hours. And then they're getting up for lauds, which is around sunrise, and then they will go through the rest of their day. We do know that the canonical hours were stretched out during the summertime and they were shrunk down during the wintertime. It gives us an idea that people were going to bed earlier in winter and they were getting up earlier in summer. Now, I'm wondering if Mary Kay is coming to this question because there was a whole bunch of stuff that keeps coming around in the news cycle about biphasic sleep. So there's a guy named Roger Eckrich that came up with some research about whether people had a first sleep and a second sleep. I haven't found any research about first sleeps and second sleeps in the Middle Ages outside of his work. So the idea behind Eckrich's work is that people would have a first sleep, then they'd get up and do things, then they'd have a second sleep. And he's referring to things where people are testifying, saying this thing happened after my first sleep. He mentions that people are getting up in the night to do things like replenish wood, waking up and having sex. Maybe they're taking care of their children in the middle of the night. This doesn't necessarily mean that this is coordinated, right? Where everybody is having one sleep and then waking up and then having a second sleep. These are things that people do wake up to do. You have to feed the fire. You might get intimate with your partner. You might be taking care of your children. This is stuff that is happening. It is interrupting people's sleep. But I'm not sure that it shows that people are having one sleep and then getting up and then having a second one. So how does this work with people who actually get up in the middle of the night, like monks and nuns? Well, fortunately for us, monks and nuns still exist, right? There are people who are still living according to the canonical hours, and they have been studied. So this is a really cool study that was called Ring the Bell for Matins, Circadian Adaptation to Split Sleep by Cloistered Monks and Nuns. I'm going to have the link to this article for you on the show notes when it shows up on medievalist.net, because I think this is really interesting. So in this study, they looked at 5 monks and 5 nuns who had been following the canonical hours and getting up for matins to pray for anywhere between 5 and 46 years. So they had always been doing this since they had become monks and nuns. How did this affect their bodies? Well, this is really interesting because their bodies prepared themselves, according to this study, to wake up for matins because they were so used to it. But at the same time, and this is a quote from the abstract, they reported difficulties with sleep latency, sleep duration, and daytime function, and more frequent hypnagogic hallucinations. In contrast to their daytime silence, they experienced conversations and occasionally prayers in dreams. So this is really interesting, I think, because it shows us that people who have a biphasic sleep schedule where they get up for a couple hours and then they go back to sleep, they actually have some cognitive dysfunction. Now, this makes sense in a monastic context because it's supposed to be a very difficult life. But in an everyday context, this sounds really horrible. Someone who's had to get up with children for years in the middle of the night, I can testify to the fact that it's difficult to get up in the middle of the night. That's not to say that it didn't happen. In short, Mary Kay, we don't have a lot of evidence for sleep outside of the monastic context, but what we do know from modern studies of the monastic context, it's actually pretty interesting how disruptive it can be to get up in the middle of the night. So were people doing it outside of the monastery? We just don't know. So next, Sebastiano sent me an email and he said, are there any documents that tell us about people who are trying to go through passages to hell? So Sebastiano's saying, some people thought there were gateways to hell on earth. Do we know a lot about what was happening to these people? Did they go through these hell gates or hell mouths? Well, I don't really know of anyone that did this in real life. We do have some suggestions about where you might find a gateway to hell. Some people suggest that it was thought that in Iceland, the volcanoes were gateways to hell. I can see that, where you have all this spitting lava. It looks very fiery. When Dante wrote his Inferno, he says he came across Virgil in the middle of wilderness and forest. So that is where he found a way down to hell, although he didn't need a guide to do it. But it's mostly that we find people ending up in hell through literature. And it's funny that Dante mentions being in the middle of the woods because the woods can be kind of scary, but that's also where you have demonic contact or contact with the fairy world in literature. So I'm thinking of the romance of Sir Gawther, whose mom is impregnated by the devil or a devil under a tree and has a devil spawned kid. So there's that example. There's also Sir Orfeo, in which a woman falls asleep under a tree and is kidnapped by the fairy king. So you might find a gateway to hell or to fairyland in the woods. So that's a dangerous place to be. Most of the time in medieval culture, you came across hell or demons when you were asleep. So this is a vulnerable time, not just in literature, but in real life as well. So there are lots of demonic visions that are said to happen at night, or that's when you might have a vision of what hell looks like, or you might see one of your friends there. In sermon stories, you know, someone will have a sleep and then they will have a conversation with somebody who they find out is in hell. So it's usually happening when people are asleep. In other places in culture, you have a hell mouth that's painted on the side of a cathedral or a church, and people are dragged into Satan's mouth, which is pretty dramatic, I think. This is something that you also see in medieval drama. So unless you are seeing the mouth of the devil open, you're probably pretty safe, but you might not want to take a nap underneath a tree in the middle of a forest because you might be taking chances there. So thanks for your question, Sebastiano. That is where I see people coming across gates into hell. Tim asked a really important question too, which I think is definitely worth taking a second to answer. Tim said, did English manor lords provide support for elderly serfs with no family to take care of them, or for a serf who could no longer perform work? So first of all, Tim, shout out to you. This question came to me through medievalist.net's Patreon. So thanks, Tim, for your patronage and for your question. I think this is an important question because people frequently say, you know, the average medieval life ended when they were around 40. But people didn't actually drop dead the second that they turned 40. There were a lot of elderly people. When we talk about the average age of death, we're not talking about everybody. It's a statistical thing. I know that I'm preaching to the choir, people who are listening to my podcast, but I think it's important to take a second and remember, people didn't drop dead at 40. So what happened to them? Well, there were lots of different ways in society that a person could be taken care of. And usually, as Tim's suggesting in his question, this is done by family. And people were reliant on their families and on their neighbors and on their friendships. And we know this happens a lot in legal text, right? If somebody needs help, they have witnesses in the community that will say, you know, this is a good person. And it's the same when it comes to support. People were not stupid back in the day. They realized that when they became elderly, they might not be able to work, so they tried to put contingency plans into place. And the thing is about age is it does happen gradually, so you can make plans for that. So you might set aside some money. If you had some money, you might make an arrangement with your children or with their children to take care of you, or you might make an arrangement with a neighbor to make sure that you are taken care of in your old age if you're no longer able to work. So most of the time people did make arrangements with other people to do that. You can read about this really in a succinct way in an article called Social Welfare and Mutual Aid in the Medieval Countryside by Elaine Clark, which I'll give you a link to as well. So in the event that you didn't have close family or friends, you might still arrange for yourself to take on a caretaker. You would pay them basically, or you would let them live on your property and they would take care of that for you. If you are not able to do that, English law suggested that your property would be taken into the hands of the lord, who would provide a guardian or a caretaker for the property to make sure that it's getting farmed, so that, of course, the lord gets his money from it, his rent or his agricultural goods. If you had more money than that, so if you were somebody who had actual land holdings, that land would go into the guardianship of the king. In both cases, you were meant to be taken care of out of the resources that were provided by that land that belongs to you or that you were a tenant of. So basically, you're kind of subletting and people are taking care of you and you're being taken care of based on what the land can provide for you. So people were actually planning ahead for this. And hopefully they had relatives and neighbors that would be helpful to them. You didn't want to end up being destitute in the Middle Ages. But even if that happened to you, even if you were totally destitute, you didn't have any resources, you didn't have any land you could live on, you didn't have any relatives, there were still places where you could be taken care of. And those places would be monasteries, almshouses, and hospitals. These are not the best places to age out, but there were resources. So often you weren't left completely destitute and on the street. There were places that you could go to. And in fact, many people retired to a monastery, allowing for other people to take care of their resources and allowing themselves to have a relatively comfortable retirement. I say relatively comfortable because if you were still able to go to mass in the middle of the night, they would make you go to mass at the middle of the night, like we were talking about earlier. But if you were really infirm, you wouldn't have to do that. And you could actually live in the infirmary and be taken care of there. But yes, Tim, if you aged out and you were no longer able to work, you could have people take care of your land and you would still be able to live off that. Or the Lord would take the land and find a guardian for it and for you so that you would be taken care of. You're not usually just booted off the land and left to your own devices. And if that happened, you could rely on a monastery or an almshouse. Now, Elizabeth asked me about seals. So Elizabeth's question was, who created the royal seal for a king? And when he died, did that seal pass on to his heir, or was it destroyed and a new seal created for the heir? Would the same rules apply for a nobleman or a prominent man of the church, such as a bishop? See, these are such interesting and good questions. Okay, so let's answer the first question first. Who made seals? This is a very good question, I think. Seals are mostly made from metal, which meant that metal workers made them. So for average people who needed a seal, and this could be anybody, a townsperson, it could be pretty much anyone who could afford one, they were made by tinsmiths. So they are made of an alloy, not a very expensive metal, but they were carved by tinsmiths. Up the chain, you have ones that are made by silversmiths. So most of the important people will have their seals being made by silversmiths who are creating that for them, and they're creating personal seals. Now, because seals were made out of things like silver, they could be quite pretty. I mean, you'd want to get the best artist that you could to make your seal for you, right? It could be quite pretty. And so some people wore signet rings so they could have their seals with them all the time. They could show off a little bit of jewelry. It was the best of both worlds. When you died, your seal was destroyed. So it could be snapped in half if it was a flat one. It could be melted down. There was at least one Bishop of Durham, I think it's Thomas Hatfield, but I will put the link up there for you, that had his seal melted down and it was turned into a picture of him that was put above the shrine of St. Cuthbert. So his seal was melted down and turned into something beautiful and commemorative. So even kings and queens had their seals either buried with them or broken or melted down so that people could not impersonate them later. So I don't know if this is helpful to you, Elizabeth, or not, but people did have their seals either destroyed or buried with them so that no one else could use their seal. And finally, I was asked a question that gave me an excuse to come back around to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. So let's end with that one. The question from Black Madonna Heart on Twitter is, what is the green man doing in churches and cathedrals? What is he all about? So what was the green man all about? This is a really good question to which we don't have a satisfactory answer, something that we are still looking into. There are a whole bunch of different theories about the green man. So let's get into some of them. So the green man is an image usually of a guy. He's a grotesque. It's often just his face, making a grotesque face. It's carved into cathedrals and churches all over the United Kingdom especially, and he's got leaves all around him. He's got leaves coming out of his face. He's coming out of his ears and mouth and all of that kind of thing. Now, we don't know where the green man comes from. Some people have suggested over time that he might be a remnant of Celtic paganism. Some people have suggested that he is a remnant of Roman Bacchanalia type stuff, that he is representing Bacchus. Overall, it seems pretty clear that he's representing nature in some way. He's a creature that is half natural. He's half leafy. He's something that is definitely from the natural world and not from the civilized world or the urban environment. Nobody actually knows if the green man is supposed to be a benign figure or a threatening figure. Now, this is interesting when you think about it because nature is likewise both comforting and threatening. So there have been some suggestions that maybe he is disliked by the church because he's natural and therefore he's a symbol of fertility. A lot of this stuff is covered in a book called The Green Man in Britain by Fran and Jeff Dole. Perhaps he is epitomizing nature and its fertility. Maybe this is threatening to the church, but we also know that green was a color that was very important to the church. It was used in liturgy. It was a color that was meant to be healing for monks, although in the cloister garth where they had a green lawn, that was meant to be kind of tamed, not wild like the green man. But it's really hard to say whether he's supposed to be threatening or not. As anyone who went camping this summer might remember, it can be pretty threatening in the greenwood, right? When you are maybe lost, maybe on the way to the outhouse and you're in the middle of the night with just a flashlight, the green can be pretty scary. Also in the Middle Ages, the greenwood is where outlaws hung out, right? But the green is also a very soothing and natural place for us. So this is a long way to say nobody actually knows what's going on with the green man, but it's really interesting that he shows up in my favorite poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. People have connected the green knight with the green man. It seems pretty evident to me that he is meant to be connected or reminiscent of the green man because he is showing up, first of all, entirely in green. He's a very natural figure in that he's got long hair, he's got a long beard, he's got a horse that matches with him. And while he has a bunch of the accoutrements of quote-unquote civilization, he also has a holly branch in his hand, which is one of the few plants that is green in the United Kingdom in the middle of December. So he's very much connected to the natural world. He calls himself the Knight of the Green Chapel, and when Gawain finally finds the Green Chapel, he finds it is a cleft in a crag that is also very green and very natural. And then he finds out that, as if it's not already evident, it's evident to everybody from the beginning, that the Green Man is magical. He's fey. He is from the other world. He's a supernatural, magical figure. And so it's fun to think about the Green Man, especially because it gives me an opportunity to, you know, fangirl about Sir Gawain again. But we don't actually know what he's doing there. And for anybody who likes to buy frozen canned vegetables, you can see the green man still showing up in your frozen vegetable section at the grocery store in the form of green giants. So this is something that's still around today, this idea of a green man who is benign but also a giant. He's continually interesting to us all the way up till today, which I think is fascinating. So I want to thank everybody for your questions. Thanks for asking them. I love to find out what's going on with people's minds, what they're thinking about, what they're trying to figure out about the Middle Ages. Rest assured, we're still trying to figure out the answers to all of these things too. I wish I could get more specific about things like diapers, but we are going to have to keep waiting for people to dig up more research about that. So thanks again, everybody. Thank you for following me on social media and especially for your contributions on Patreon, which make it possible for me to do this podcast in affiliation with medievalist.net. As an indie historian, it's really important to me to get that support because it actually allows me to make a living doing this history for you. So thank you so much to everybody who's following me and especially those people who are on Patreon. I hope that you are finding all sorts of great stuff on Patreon. We have those subscriptions to magazines, right, where you can learn more about the medieval world and you can support your favorite podcaster at the same time. So thanks, everybody. I hope you have enjoyed this episode and I hope that you've learned something fun that you can tell somebody else about today and really share this great love of the Middle Ages that we share together. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Well, I've been watching first episode of House of the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what all medievalists must be watching, right?
I think so, until Lord of the Rings comes up.
So what's your take on it, anyways?
As with a lot of medieval stuff these days, like I think that the sets and costumes are beautiful and the performances are just amazing. I really liked Matt Smith's performance especially, but it's so violent. It's so violent, stomach-turningly violent. And I don't know. I don't know if I have the emotional stamina to see it through because I know that the showrunners are telling us that there's going to be more violence and especially more violence against women's bodies. And this first episode was already pretty horrific in that regard. So yeah. What about you? What are you thinking?
Well, I guess I wasn't particularly impressed by this show. I kind of felt it was really in the same vein as Game of Thrones, which is to be expected. But I guess I want something a little different. And it just does seem like lots of violence and backroom political stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it is Game of Thrones. Well, what are you hoping for? More sparkles?
I don't know. I don't like. You will always have something new, at least a bit of a refreshing. But it's hard to tell after one episode. I found it really odd that they talked about how violent it, especially that tournament, right? Was and they make that comment, like characters. Well, we haven't had a war in 70 years. They haven't had any reason to be fighting. And I kind of thought that would have made the society, especially the nobility, so much more peaceful.
Well,
it doesn't make sense logically. Now they just kill themselves in sport, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is explained by the characters as being kind of inevitable, but there's the continuing debate, right? Is this quote-unquote realistic to the Middle Ages? Well, that's kind of moot because it's a fantasy world, so I guess you can take what the characters are saying at face value.
True.
Is a super violent society, and I guess you can only expect people are going to kill each other no matter what the circumstances. But certainly, this is not what it was like in the real Middle Ages.
Oh, no, it's
that's
not
moot.
Like, you know, like I just thought, like the internal logic of the show, right? Of having a lot of people that still do want to be warriors, but there has been no war because the entire continent has been at peace, apparently, for 70 years. So it makes them redundant in a way.
It has definitely the feeling that it's not for long, not for long.
Maybe they'll have another large scale meeting where everyone votes on who the next heir will be.
Yeah.
Like they did that in the first 2 minutes. It was done. It was nice. Everyone had their say and kingdom went on. So that could happen.
Yeah, but not in this world.
Yeah, I'll keep watching it. It is such a beautiful kind of scenery. And I want to see like the performances as well. They put a lot of money into these things. So
so you're going to give them an A for effort?
Yeah, A for effort. C+ overall so far. But, you know, it's one episode in. So,
yep. I mean, you always have to iron out the wrinkles after the pilot. But yeah, it is beautifully shot and the performances are really good. But it's like super trigger warnings before you watch anything Game of Thrones. And I think that's consistent here.
If you've seen Game of Thrones, you know what you're going to expect here.
So what's going on otherwise?
Well, we've got a piece by Jack Wilson about the Mongols and silk. And one of my very first memories about the Middle Ages is watching a TV documentary about the Mongols invading Europe. And they made a big point of saying that the Mongols wore silk so that arrows would not pierce them. Like, this was their armor, right? And it made them so effective. And Wilson's piece just debunks all that, right? It all comes back from one historian thinking that modern bulletproof vests were made with silk back in around the early 20th century. So he's saying, well, if they're made with silk, that's because they can stop a bullet. And if they can stop a bullet, they can stop an arrow.
Okay, and this is debunking this.
Yeah, and this went on, and that's why the guys remember seeing in a documentary and it kind of popularized in books. And I never kind of gave it two thoughts. I said, oh yes, that must be true. But no, Mongols did not wear silk as armor. And it was a really interesting piece of what actually they made use of silk. It was even money. It was basically a currency, which is really fascinating. Yeah, so I really recommend that one, Mongols and Silk by Jack Wilson. We have another fascinating article about this lost kingdom off the Welsh coast. Is called Canterer Gwlad. I'm butchering
You're a
that
native
name. Yeah,
Welsh
I'm a native
speaker.
Welshman. Ah.
I think you're a bit more like a pirate, yeah.
So there was these legends that first come around in the 13th century that there was this land off the coast of Wales that was kind of protected from the sea by dikes. But then, the dikes broke through. There was always someone at fault. And then the place became submerged and lost. And now, there's a lot more evidence kind of piling up. There's this land off Cardigan Bay, which is just immediately west of Wales, of large areas that would have been overland. And there's even images of it in the Go map, which is like the earliest map we have of Britain. They're clearly there, right? Two big islands, and no one's thought about it before, but a couple of scholars have looked into it and they're kind of presenting the case. It's really fascinating. I thought it anyways.
Well, I guess we're all going to find it fascinating because we're going to be reading it on medievalist.net, right?
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. What else we got? We got Lucy Lamagnier, more on medieval hospitals. And yeah, and Ken Monshine also has another piece on the House of the Dragon. Getting ready for your Game of Thrones fix on medievalist.
Yes, I'm sure that there are going to be lots of people looking for more information about the Middle Ages, thanks to House of the Dragon. So we can be grateful for that. Well, thanks, Peter, for giving us the scoop on what you thought of House of the Dragon and everything going on medievalist.net.
Thanks.
For everything from questions to quests, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. You can also find my new digital downloads at daniellesabalski.com/shop. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.